My name is Father Gregory Pine. Welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for another installment of Off-Campus Conversations. And as is sometimes our custom, we don't venture too far afield. So as it happens, today I'm in the same building as the individual whom I am interviewing. So it's a delight to be joined by Father James Dominic Brent. Thanks for joining Off-Campus Conversations.
It's great to be here with you.
All right. So Father James, you hail from the great state of Michigan. You did some studies at Wayne State University, at St. Louis University, and you obtained your PhD there in philosophy under the tutelage of Professor Eleanor Stump. And you've been teaching here at the Pontifical Faculty of the Immaculate Conception for about a decade, a little over a decade. Folks might know you from a book that you recently published, Father's House, academic publications of various sorts. And then you've just been super generous with Thomistic Institute lectures and conferences and retreats here, there, everywhere. And now you have a podcast called Contemplata, a podcast for contemplative souls, which folks can find wherever they consume their podcasts. But maybe, I don't know, by way of alternative introduction, what are some things that you're cooking up here in the last couple of months or the last couple of years that you're excited about, whether things I mentioned or other things besides?
Well, one of the things I've been working on the most is studying the wisdom of John Paul II. I had a course at the house last semester called The Philosophy of Karawutiwa. That's a project I've been working on off and on for a long time now, ever since I was in graduate school, really, when I was first introduced to his writings. And as the years have gone on, I've learned more philosophy and have learned how to read and understand very different kind of philosopher that you find in Karawutiwa, different in kind from what you standardly have in the English-speaking world. And as the years have gone on and I've sort of been able to see what he's up to more and more, it's been increasingly more impressive to me, the depth of what he's actually doing. And I'm afraid that there's a lot of superficial readings of Aquinas, or I'm sorry, superficial readings of John Paul II that don't quite get to the depths of what he's up to. So that's the thing I've been working on when I have the opportunity to do significant study. So,
yeah. you were explaining to me recently that we're in a privileged time because the collected works or Opera Omnia of St. John Paul II are now becoming available in more systematic fashion. What does that project look like?
So the Catholic University of America Press is publishing his Opera Omnia, which is giving us access really for the first time in English to the extent of his pre-papal writings. And there's a archive in Krakow, and there are people who are going over there and gathering the manuscripts and translating them. A great deal of previously unpublished stuff is now being either published or translated. It's being translated into English or perhaps published for the first time, depending on its previous status. But really what's happening is we're going to have access to this, to the text of Karawutiwa in a way that generations up until now have not had access to in the English-speaking world. So there's a way in which Wojtyła studies are just getting started, even now. So there was a first generation of readers of him who gave us the broad outlines of what he was up to. And, but they were working off a very small percentage of his actual writings. So now we're actually having access to a much more expansive range. And even within the publication of the first two volumes, there's already almost 20 some essays, for example, that were previously unpublished, some of which he really explains what he's up to, what his project is, and he explains it in a kind of Thomistic ease that people can follow if they're familiar with the theology of St. Thomas. So, and that mode of discourse. So, this thing is just getting started in a way.
Nice. Okay, let's say you've got somebody listening who's read The Acting Person, who's read Love and Responsibility. They're not entirely convinced that they should go back and do the deep dive because, you know, they've done some experimentation with collected works and they've found that the things that were kind of determined to be chaff 50 years ago are still chaff now. So are there things that you have found in these first couple of volumes that have helped you in a particular way?
Yeah. So first of all, The Acting Person is quite a different work than Person and Act, which was the first volume of the Opera Omnia that was just translated. And in Person and Act, you can see a Thomistic sort of influence that's much more significant than you can see in the old translation, if we even want to call it a translation, of the acting person. So you can see just how thoroughly imbued with the wisdom of St. Thomas he is. And you can also see that he's carrying out a kind of reflection upon experience. And he's very clear he's not doing a phenomenological project per se. He distinguishes his methodology from phenomenology, which is an important point. For a long time, people were going around saying JP2 is fusing phenomenology and metaphysics when he's pretty clear he's not. He's doing something distinct altogether. He's significant because he developed his own methodology. There's really two thinkers in the 20th century that thought most, two Catholic philosophers who thought most deeply about method in the 20th century. One was Bernard Lonergan. The other is Karol Wojtyła. So he was very much thinking about methodological questions and sort of pioneers his own method in philosophy. But you can see from the new translation of Person and Act just how much he's drawing from and thinking with Thomas Aquinas, much more so than in the original translation of the acting person. That being said, there's also in the back of the new volume that has come out, explanatory essays where he explains his project again in a kind of Thomistic ease. He's like giving papers at conferences where he's explaining to Thomas what he's up to. He knows his audience. He's able to speak in their Thomistic mode, and he lays out what he's up to. And I find it very clarifying. So that by itself is going to be worth reading. Love and Responsibility also has a new translation, and also responses to objections that were raised to Love and Responsibility back in the day. He hears those objections and he responds to them in these essays that have been translated. So these things are new, and to the extent that people want to understand his wisdom, they're worth reading.
Yeah. So I have a question about what you said regarding methodology. I just read Sokolowski's Eucharistic Presence, and he spend some time in that work distinguishing between like metaphysical discourse and phenomenological discourse. And he talks about this notion of like disclosure or manifestation as part and parcel of, well, dot, dot, dot. I don't know that we need to describe that at any length. But, you know, that's a pretty bold statement that it's Bernard Lonergan and Karol Wojtyła who think most among Catholic philosophers on this particular point of method. Maybe for the uninitiate, those who don't necessarily know the ins and outs of this question, what's particular about his method? What are the ways in which he engages these questions deliberately and intentionally? How does that help us to approach him in his approach to God and reality?
So he understands the phenomenological method. He's read a lot of Shaler, and he's, you know, inspired by it in various ways, but he's also opposed to certain conclusions Shaler arrives at through the phenomenological method that he uses. And John Paul II is quite aware that at the critical thing in the phenomenological method is this bracketing, okay? And the great discussions within phenomenological thinking is what is bracketing, what do you need to do in order to bracket, and whatnot. And he takes the whole notion of the bracketing and itself, in a way, sets it aside. So he's not interested in suspending judgment about the existential status of things independent of experience, or avoiding talking about things in themselves, just in favor of talking about things in the manner in which they're given to us. So John Paul II is a realist philosopher in this sense, that he wants to get to what is really real prior to and independently of our mind. But he thinks that there's something of value in the phenomenological approach, which is starting from experience, or the return to things as they're given in original experience. So he begins to talk about integral experience, which is a combination of both your empirical experience and your self experience, the experience of your own interiority, the experience of your own life, the experience of your own action, what we might in common parlance call your life experience. And he acknowledges that empirical experience is part of your life experience, but it's not the whole. So instead of starting from empirical experience exclusively, he starts from what he calls integral experience. And this is the point he makes many times. The starting point is integral experience. And even more specifically, says the starting point is the integral experience of man. So he sees himself as a 21st century human being living in modernity in a specific set of circumstances after the calamities of the world wars and after the calamities of, you know, the Second World War in particular, and the way they ravished his country. And he wants to reflect upon the lived experience, the situation in which we as a human race find ourselves at this point in time, in order to actually go forward in, you could say, the recovery of fallen humanity. Okay, so there's a way in which he, I guess you could say, he sees himself as something like the Good Samaritan who is coming along to pick up the man who's been robbed and is lying at the side of the road. Who's the man who's robbed lying at the side of the road? It's man, it's humanity. And the kind of philosophy he wants to develop is not one that just simply gets things right at the scientific level and gets all your principles and causal story in order in a speculative way. He's very clear in his essay, Thomistic Personalism, that personalism and the project he wants to carry out is practical in its orientation. So this is about serving humanity and helping the recovery of fallen humanity in some way. So there's a practical program that goes with this. It's not just a speculative project. It's also practical in its orientation as well. But the starting point is integral experience. Okay, so in that way, it differs from a merely or a purely Aristotelian approach, which starts exclusively with empirical experience, but it differs also from a phenomenological approach, which practices bracketing. So there's a reflection upon our life experience, our collective communal life experience together as human beings, in order to find a way to live more fully as persons in a completely personal world. That's what he's up to.
Okay, so I'm interested in this kind of the notion of, I don't know, salvation is the right word, but this notion of, like you said, service to humanity. Because I'm thinking of like ancient paradigms for that. You know, you have that in the medical arts, you have that in the dramatic arts. You even have that to a certain extent in the political arts. Like there's this sense that man needs to be delivered from certain weaknesses or woundednesses of his estate without, you know, like introducing the gospel. That's not to say that the gospel need to be held at arm's length, but there's just to say that, you know, proper to man as a creature, we're talking here in the order of nature, not yet in the order of grace. There's a kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, like a therapeutic dimension to our common human pilgrimage. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because I think a lot of Christians hearing that, they really only conceive of salvation as something explicitly Christian, as something attendant upon the gospel and encounter with Jesus Christ. But there's something there in the culture.
Sure. In the last couple of decades or so, a number of historians of ancient philosophy have emphasized that in the ancient world, philosophy had sort of three components, or each school of philosophy had three things it tried to address, or factors that were involved in the development of their philosophies. On the one hand, there's theory, there's an account of the world in which we live, or theoria. There's a practice, so a set of practices that need to be carried out in order to be good and become good. But then there's also therapeia, there's a therapy. There was an acknowledgement by ancient philosophers who were pagan that human beings are broken in some way, or they need healing. Not only did they need healing in their bodies, like the medical arts address, they need a kind of soul healing. And that analogy, like you find a lot in Plato, for example, as the physician heals the body, so the teacher or the philosopher or Socrates heals the soul. And so on the ancient understanding, it's the responsibility of philosophers to engage in all three of these, theory, practice, and therapy. And one of the points that Hadot makes in his book, Philosophy as a Way of Life, is he really thinks that modern philosophy as an university academic discipline no longer engages in all three of these. Somewhere along the way, he tells the story about somehow or another along the way, philosophy becomes a purely theoretical discipline that's taken up in the universities and becomes one specialization among others. And so the other pieces have fallen out. And Hadot is clearly trying to revive some kind of ancient, or we could say neo-pagan sort of practice for a kind of secularized Europe that's post-Christian but wants a meaningful life. Nonetheless, he proposes a kind of more robust form of philosophy, which involves all three. Well, long before Hadot came along, I mean, John Paul II, I think, already sees as part of the classic sort of philosophical project to be doing all three of these. So his Thomistic personalism or personalistic Thomism, however you want to describe it, the form of philosophy that John Paul II is carrying out has got all three goals in mind, or all three practices as part of it. There's definitely a theoretical component, there's definitely a practical, and there's definitely a therapeutic component to it.
Yeah. No, it strikes me that, like, you know, when you think about the life of St. John Paul II, you see him as a man who is attuned to the personal, social, cultural, you know, obviously religious, latruic needs of man. And he's kind of, there's a kind of midwifery there where he's calling us to a certain nobility of purpose, to a certain dignity of action. And it's, yeah, it's educative, but it's also, yeah, I don't know exactly what the right word is, therapeutic, I suppose. We think of something else when we say that nowadays. But yeah, like he's trying to teach us to think well about our estate, and in thinking well, to attain to a kind of transformation or transcendence. Not, again, not possible to bracket the gospel. He's a thoroughly gospel man. So he's not going to say, I'm doing this qua philosopher, I'm doing this qua theologian, in the way in which people want to make distinctions about, you know, St. Thomas's work, for instance. But yeah, there's this humanity there. Yeah. And with that humanity, there's a kind of humanizing tendency in the whole of his body of work, even when it's not explicitly Christian, or it's not, you know, kind of, its finality isn't the proclamation of the gospel in the same way that a properly theological work or charismatic work or catechetical work might be. But maybe we can think there too about,
sure,
his project, you know, kind of his overall project, and like what he's trying to teach or how he's helping us to think. Yeah, maybe you can situate us,
sure,
in that conversation, how you see St. John Paul II's contribution now, some 20 years after his death.
Okay, well, I'll give you a concrete example. So it's clear that one of his main themes is the dignity of the human person. And when he thinks about the human person, he always thinks of the person in communion. Okay, so he thinks this is the original calling of human beings by grace, is to be called into this communion with the Most High God, with the Holy Trinity. And it belongs to our dignity, okay, to have this calling, and to be called into this communio. And that's how we can best understand what persons are, what our dignity is in communion. Okay. But it's clear that he's kind of like a prophetic defender of human dignity in the second half of the 20th century. Why did he feel compelled to go there, to that topic, to that theme? One is obviously the atrocities that he experienced in his own country growing up. He makes a point in his, when he's preaching the retreat to the papal household in the 1970s, he's preaching to Paul VI, and he fields an objection against himself, actually. He says, people say that the Archbishop of Krakow is excessively concerned with the dignity of human life and the question of abortion. But then he just replies and he says, how could the Archbishop of the diocese that has Auschwitz in it not be concerned about the dignity of and protection of human life? And it really struck me when I read that, wow, he was the bishop of the diocese that had the most notorious concentration camp of the Second World War in it. And so that's the kind of background or horizon against which he's doing his thinking and his philosophizing. And he also is obviously experiencing communist oppression in Poland as a bishop well after the Second World War. Now, recently, I had the opportunity to speak with someone connected with one of our TI chapters, actually, who grew up in China. And so he grew up under communist system. And as we sat down and talked, and we were talking about John Paul II, we started to talk about what life in a communist regime is actually like. And this young man said to me, the first thing you have to understand about life in a communist regime is that the basic message you're sent every day is, you have no dignity. You have no worth. You're basically a clog in the machine of the state, and you're as useful as your labor. And you have no more dignity or worth than that. Your worth, your value is measured exclusively in terms of your labor utility. That's it. So when I heard him say that, it really sort of illuminated a lot what John Paul II is up to, that he really was doing his philosophy from out of this background where every day in their society, the Polish people were being told, you have no intrinsic dignity. You have no worth other than what you're able to produce or labor input you have for the interests of the state or the collective. And he's really opposing that sort of first principle of the kind of communist system, like directly confronting it. So his philosophy has that kind of a culture or spiritual moral warfare in it. That's what he's doing. Now, if you think that the communist threat is simply gone, or that and that Marxism has simply dissolved, and that it's just no longer a factor in human affairs anymore, then you would say, yeah, okay, that's all like 50 years ago and or 75 years ago, and that's gone. But you might think, no, actually, maybe the Marxist philosophy has made its way to the West, has permeated the mind of the West, and is at work in maybe more or less clandestine ways in the West. And people are subtly being given a message every day. You really don't have any intrinsic dignity and worth. You really are just as good as your job and your rank and your status in society. And that's it. Like that's what you are. So, and also you might think that there's like a, you might think, well, yeah, there's no propaganda machine going in our society the way there was and in the Soviet Union. Or you might think there's actually a much more sophisticated propaganda machine going in our society than there was back then. So when you study the ins and outs of his philosophy, what I've discovered is it really does, especially when he talks a lot about consciousness and the formation of conscience, there's a lot there that you can see it's meant to help people in acquire an interior form of a person, of a fully integrated person who's aware of his own transcendence, his transcendence of material conditions. You can become interiorly, personally, subjectively aware of your own dignity, integration, and transcendence, even though all the structures in your society around you are sending you the opposite message and trying actively every day to undermine your own integration, the sense of your transcendence and your own sense of your dignity. So it's a philosophy that's designed to form Catholics, to form human beings, frankly, to form human beings and Catholics to survive an extremely oppressive system that reaches into the depths of the human psyche every day to manipulate, to dominate, to disintegrate human beings. And if you think that kind of philosophy is useful, then you might be interested in the philosophy of John Paul II.
Yeah. It strikes me that that gives, and this isn't a big or a significant point, but that gives a really helpful background to the notion of freedom, which St. John Paul II proposes at various points during, I'm just thinking of the papal documents of his magisterium. You know, because, yeah, you can come at that question from various perspectives, social and political, but this idea that you have a kind of freedom of interiority, you have a kind of freedom of integration, you have a kind of freedom of transcendence, which is a freedom for, and, you know, like the word that probably comes up most often in the things that we've all read as gift, you know, to make an offering of yourself ultimately. It's like you lay claim to yourself so that you can give yourself away, which I think that resonates with a lot of people, even if they don't necessarily get into the details of what he's describing there. But yeah, maybe could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, a couple things about that. First of all, one of the great discoveries I made over the last year or so is that John Paul II has a much more robust metaphysical vision than you might at first realize, because for so long people have been saying he's basically interested in man. He's basically a phenomenologist. These kinds of things. It's true. The great topic he has in mind is man, and he's an anthropologist, and an ethicist. Those were like his areas of specialization. But there's no doubt that behind it, he's got a metaphysics. And as I've studied it, I've been able to kind of summarize it in a simple statement. It's a metaphysics of love. And it just, here's the first principle of the whole thing. Whatever exists is either God or a gift of God. Okay. So if you just take that, whatever exists as God or a gift of God, that's like how he sees reality as a whole. And then he's got a kind of practical principle that goes with it. Whenever God gives a gift, he gives a task along with it. So everything other than God is both a gift and a task. So this is how we can think about life in the world, practically speaking. We think about being given a gift and a task that goes with it. So basically everything other than God is a gift and a task for us. Okay, so you can think of your own life. Your own life is a gift God has given you. And there's also a task. You have many gifts to be developed. Society is a gift and a task. Government is a gift and a task. Marriage is a gift and a task. So he really has this metaphysics of love in which everything is either God or a gift of God. And with every gift of God comes a task for us to work on responsibly to bring it to its fulfillment, to its completion, to its perfection. So I'm really thinking about this metaphysics of love he has going. And if this could be spelled out, then you go back to the discussions about making a gift of yourself and whatnot. And you can see that those points which he often makes in the theology of the body or in love and responsibility, those ethical points or spiritual points are made against the background of a large metaphysical vision of the world as this ordered set of gifts from God. It's very beautiful and it's very biblical in its inspiration. And he really lines it up with the Thomistic metaphysics, especially he loves the third way, the argument from contingent being and the understanding that God gives being to everything other than himself, including the essences of things, of course. So that's kind of how in many places I see him commending the argument from contingent being. And really, that's kind of in a way that's what really sets up his metaphysical picture. Okay, so that's something to say about the metaphysical side of it and the gift of self. There was another point you were asking about.
Specifically about freedom. It seems that freedom occurs often in his writings, but this idea that, you know, you've received and the purpose for which you receive is ultimately to give back. So this idea of, you know, gift and task, I think dovetails nicely.
It does. But there's a couple of other things to say about freedom that are important. So yeah, when he talks about within this metaphysics of love, where everything other than God is a gift of God, he talks about man being a gift, the imago Dei being a gift. He even starts to talk about being, ens commune, being a gift, and the transcendentals being a gift. It's like truth itself is a gift that God gives to the human person, and goodness is a gift that God gives to the human person, so that we'll know the good and choose the good. We'll know the truth and choose the good, the true good. He thinks about agency within this, like, free agency is like, to be a free agent is to be a participant in the transcendentals, really. You're participating in this reality that's shot through with truth and goodness, and you're receiving the truth and goodness, and you're responding to it freely. And the personalistic norm and the law of love are really a specification of how you do that. They're guides to that. But another thing that's important to say about his reflections on freedom would have a specific interest to Americans. So he had a certain diagnosis of what was going wrong in Eastern Europe and the totalitarian systems. There he thought there was a domination by materialist philosophies. Okay. So Marxist kind of materialism, dialectical materialism, had come to permeate the psyche of Eastern Europe. And it's deeply materialist in its habit of mind now. So that's the problem that's going on in Eastern Europe. When he looks to the West, he sees a different problem, although I do think materialist philosophies have come to dominate Western consciousness now equally as much. But he sees a different problem. He thinks that the problem in the West is a concept of freedom, in which freedom is basically absolute autonomy. So it's freedom without reference to the truth. So this, he thinks, is the core issue in the Western world, that Western human beings have come to think of their own freedom as this absolute autonomy that has no reference to truth, as he puts it. So what does he mean when he talks about like freedom without reference to the truth, freedom without reference to the truth? It's the kind of expression he would use, but wouldn't define. He would just use it, and it would leave people kind of scratching their heads, wondering, what do you mean by freedom without reference to the truth? But if you go back and dig down into person and act, you can see what he means. And it's actually very radical and very profound. So he has this notion of the human person as having many different orders, like body, soul, and spirit, orders of activities, different parts and different interests, and different goods we're seeking. And we have before us a task of becoming integrated. Okay. And he has a profound set of meditations on what this integration consists of. A lot of it does overlap with psychological discussions of integration. We know he was in conversation with psychologists. So there's ways in which his philosophy can become a kind of fundamental psychology. It's really, there's a lot of implications of it. But one of the principal points he makes, he asks the question, what do human beings need in order to integrate? And the basic answer that he gives is that human beings need to choose according to the truth about the good. They need to know the truth about the good and live according to the truth about the good. And his basic understanding of the human person is that in order to become an integrated human being, rather than this dissociated, fragmented, sort of bundle of parts and tendencies that are sort of scattered everywhere, the principal thing the human being needs is the truth about the good. So how do we understand that? I mean, just, you might think of it this way, and from Thomistically speaking, St. Thomas thinks the first principle of the natural law is good is to be done and pursued, evil is to be avoided. John Paul II acknowledges that teaching of St. Thomas and just says, looks at it like from the point of view of the acting person, every day of my life, I live under this law. Good is to be done and pursued, evil is to be avoided. Okay, the question is, what's the good that I should do and pursue? And what's the evil I need to avoid? And that's like the core question at the heart of every free agent, just by nature, we might say. We carry this question. What's the good that's to be done and pursued? What's the evil to be avoided? And we're continually asking that question in the depths of our hearts. And there's various things that we have to make a judgment. We have to make a free, responsible judgment about what's the good that I should do and what's the evil I should avoid. We don't want to make just any judgment. We want to make a true one. We need the truth about the good. And the more that we know the truth about the good and the more that we can act according to the truth about the good, the more that your whole being will come together, your whole personal being will come together in an integrated whole. And he sees the forces that are at work in our society, especially in a society where they're living by lies every day. I mean, this is one of the principal criticisms of the communist regimes. They propagate lies every day. These lies get into the depths of the mind and they corrupt, they subvert your ability to make a true judgment about the good. And the truth about, I mean, good is called by the name of evil, and evil is called by the name of good every day. And when these lies seep into the mind, the ability of human beings to become integrated human persons and live according to the actual dignity that they have is deeply compromised. Okay. So against the background of that kind of anthropology, the principal thing that we need is the truth about the good. Well, he looks at human beings in the West, saying, okay, you have a strong sense of being free individuals, but you don't have equally as strong of a sense of there being like objective truth about good and evil, right and wrong. There being an order of norms that governs human free choices, human free agency. And there's a massive amount of relativism, subjectivism that has permeated the Western consciousness, and that will compromise the integration and dignity of human beings equally as much, if not more, than imposed materialist philosophies like dialectical materialism coming through state propaganda. And so when he came to St. Louis, for example, in, I believe it was the late 90s, it was 98 if I recall, he came to St. Louis, and in his speeches in St. Louis, he talked a lot about the thing that American society needs is to recover a sense that freedom is for the sake of living according to the truth about the good. Americans need to somehow learn that our freedom is for the sake of doing what is truly good. And there's no other freedom that will really kind of integrate a human being. No other kind of freedom is in keeping with our actual dignity. The freedom to do whatever you want, regardless of what's true, is seriously self-destructive. And I think we're just seeing that in our society all around us.
Yeah. So there's a sense in which, you know, like a lot of St. John Paul II's pontificate will not be remembered as novel or revolutionary because he's recalling Christians to their dignity. He's recalling Christians to their tradition. He's recalling Christians to their practice of the faith, to their worship of the Most High God. But nevertheless, you know, there are things that people do over the course of their lives which go down in history by which they're remembered, you know, in the memories of subsequent generations. And there's always like a little bit of a risk of presentism when you try to weigh in on these questions too early, because in large part, it just takes time to determine what we're going to remember of an individual. But if you were to speak to that question, you know, it's been, like I said, it's been like 20 years since he's died. Ways in which St. John Paul II will be remembered by posterity, the ways in which his pontificate will be remembered, or the ways in which his service of the Christian people will be remembered. What might you identify as, you know, in the time that we have remaining, identify as his signal contributions or the things that'll go down and for the ages?
Well, that's hard to say because I don't know what future people are going to say.
Yeah.
But I think one of the signal achievements of his pontificate is that by the middle of the 80s, especially in the 85 Synod of Bishops, he gives what you could say is a normative interpretation of what the Second Vatican Council was about. So all through the 70s and even into the first years of his pontificate, there's this raging war about what is the meaning of the Second Vatican Council. And there are rival and incompatible interpretations of what it was about. And there were, yeah, just many different interpretations. So he comes along and gives a normative interpretation that the Second Vatican Council is not a revolution. It's not a paradigm shift in any radical sense of the term, like you read about in Thomas Kuhn or something like that. And the Catholic Church, it's the same Catholic Church. We hold essentially the same faith as the apostles. We have essentially the same means of sanctification that the church has always had for millennia. We're given to us by Christ. We have the same hierarchical offices and hierarchical gifts. There's been no revolution. There's been no paradigm shift. That was a very important stabilizing effect upon the entire church. You could, in a sense, say he continued to work out that sort of stabilization after the council all over the course of the rest of his pontificate. But if you were to ask, well, what was, if the council was not a revolution or a paradigm shift, what was it? I think he did believe that the church received a grace, an inspiration of the Spirit. And if you were to ask, well, what is that grace? What was that inspiration of the Spirit that was given? He would say, it was a renewal of communio. Okay, communio understood not just in the sense of communio theology or the specific school of theology, but the actual mystery of communio, which is the gift of the love between the Father and the Son, the bond of love between the Father and the Son poured forth into our hearts. So we become united with the Holy Trinity. We become participants in the life of the Holy Trinity by grace. And we're united and bonded with one another. And we live in this spirit of love. That's where we need to be grounded, rooted and grounded in love. And there are manifestations of communio of different kinds, as you read about in the Acts of the Apostles. They come together. They're devoted to the teaching of the apostles, the breaking of the bread, etc. These are manifestations of this invisible reality of communio, which is given principally in the depths of the soul. It's the grace of God. But it's going to have manifestations outwardly through the body, of the members of Christ's faithful. And I think the way to understand his thinking, this really helped me to like unlock his philosophy. Like if you think of him, his principal sort of concern is communio. He wants the human race to recover from the calamity of the 20th century. And the way for the human race to be recovered from the calamity of the 20th century, not to just to mention the calamity of all sin of all times, right, is to be drawn into this communio, which has been given to us. Thanks to the death and resurrection of the Lord and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, this is what we have received in the church. And the church is the sign, the sacrament, the universal sign, and the instrumental cause which draws all of humanity into this saving gift, this communio. And it's in this communio of light and love that we are saved for eternity. So he devotes his entire pontificate, I think, first to giving us this interpretation. This is what the council is about. It's not a revolution. It's not a paradigm shift. It's a renewal of the grace of communio. And here is what it looks like in practice. And here's the apostolate that comes forth from the communio. And that is what you can see him carrying out in his extensive world travels and preaching. He's carrying out an apostolate that is seeking to edify or to build up the communio all across the face of the earth. So I think that the stabilizing interpretation of the Second Vatican Council as being principally about the gift of communio, understanding the church specifically in light of that gift, and the extensive apostolate that goes and begins to draw huge numbers of people into that in a whole new way, that is going to be the thing that's going to be remembered. And part of that apostolic activity is the output of a huge amount of writing in encyclicals and whatnot. And I think it's time for not just time. I mean, it's time for a lot of people to start reading a lot of the things that he had to say. There's a tremendous wisdom there. And, it can continue to have a stabilizing influence upon us now in a time when the church really needs that.
Hmm. Well, yeah, lots of things to think about. I suppose that's been a way to wind up, but, there's a lot there. And it's, I think it's an especially propitious time for it because as the other great societies, disintegrate, not necessarily individually, but corporately, you think about the confusion in the family, you think about the confusion in the polity, to have in the church a greater solidarity and understanding of our communion, is just the type of, light of the world, salt of the earth type dynamism that you would hope to see. Obviously, we're going to suffer as a result of the breakdown of those intermediate institutions, which ought to be kind of building blocks to, or at least contribute to, the flourishing of the life of the church. But there's also a kind of wild, paradoxical gospel way in which we can, the whole can make the parts, which is cool.
I think his understanding is that that persons need the communio of the church in order to become fully persons. Human persons need that communio in order to become who they are, and they're gonna need that increasingly more as society around us breaks down.
Yeah.
So and we within the church should have a sense of consciousness of this is a gift that's been given to us, the great communio of the church, and it's a task before us.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, what's the way forward for us to become servants within this communio and servants of it, meaning to help build it up in various ways.
Yeah. Beautiful. All right. We've come to the end of our time. I just want to take the opportunity first to say thanks. And then second to direct people first to your book, The Father's House, recently published there with the Daughters of St. Paul, and to the podcast Contemplata, a podcast for contemplative souls where folks can follow up with you, conversations like this, but probably conversations often enough of a more spiritual nature, at least when it comes to that book and that podcast. But other ways in which people can kind of be in touch, be in contact, or follow up with your work, your thought.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, yeah, my joy. Turning to you then, the listener, thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Thomistic Institute podcast. If you haven't yet, subscribe on YouTube or your podcast app, unless it is not helpful for your intellectual and spiritual growth at this stage of the game, and then promptly unsubscribe. All right, Novar, prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.